Well may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.
Hello and welcome to Well May We Say, a progressive podcast about Australian politics. This is episode 48 for Friday, 9th of February, 2018. I'm Jeremy Sear, and each week I'll be joined by a different guest host to help me look into what's happening to our country and why what's going to happen, and hopefully what we can do about it. Tonight's guest host is Denise Pierco.
Hello!
Yeah, look, this is a giant list, and it's, I know it's the first real week that the politicians have been back doing things. Well, they've really got into their groove a bit this week. Some politicians a bit too much into a groove. Perhaps the groove getting into is one of the problems that they're currently facing.
And especially here in Victoria, we are in election campaigning time light.
Which is mad because we don't actually have one. Queensland
till November 24th.
No, yes, we have. Queensland is in the middle of one. Tasmania is in the middle of one. And Batman is, there's a by-election in Batman on the 17th of March.
Different Batman.
Well, the James Collies Stop the Post podcast did point out that I hadn't realised that David Feeney had been the Shadow Justice Minister. That's right, the Shadow Justice Minister was the member for Batman.
Nice.
That's hilarious. Nice. They still need to change it because
Justice from the Shadows.
The Batman that they named it after is, in fact, a terrible, evil Batman, as opposed to just the rich guy who likes punching poor people.
Exactly.
Anyway, David Feeney's gone, and there is a by-election, and so Labor is being dragged back to the. To try and, whilst fighting in Queensland, simultaneously, Adani turns out to be this giant issue in Victoria, where it's got where it's really a proxy for the ALP's general contempt for the environment and lefty matters in general. And Alex Petala only lost last time, I think, by 2,000 votes to the in the Greens to Buffini. So it will be interesting seeing how that goes. That's, I think, the 17th of March is that by-election, so that is coming up. And meanwhile, when we recorded last week, we were recording, so when Brandon and I were chatting about some of the revelations from these cabinet papers, we didn't know that time they had been discovered in literal cabinets, that second-hand cabinets that the Parliament had just chucked out. I think the Department of Prime Minister and I think the Prime Minister's office had chucked them out, is the current theory.
There's a second cabinet. Some guy found files in one of the backs of his cabinets he'd found somewhere and just turned them in.
Well, specifically we don't know who it was, because specifically the ABC has protected their sources whilst handing everything back to ASIO. Although under Christian Porter's new terrifying proposed proposed secrecy. So basically they've taken the fact that there were some concerns about foreign donations and so forth in the wake of Sam Dastyari, and they've turned that round, you know, straight after the marriage equality legislation came through, they went off to implement this legislation to try and shut down GetUp and...
convenient that was what they did.
It was not that GetUp's winning any friends at the moment. It's basically holding off on whether it's going to campaign in Batman, depending on whether the ALP switches its policy on Adani. Just flagging, by the way, because I did listen to the ABC's Party Room podcast this afternoon, and they were talking about Adani like it was a toss-up between the environment and blue-collar workers, ignoring the fact that there is very little evidence that the Adani mine would, in fact, lead to very much employment whatsoever. There's also the employment that it would take away by further destroying the reef. So whether or not it is in fact a boon for blue collar workers at all is definitely debatable.
And it's one of those issues where, sure, we're creating jobs, but we're creating jobs at such a great expense. We're creating jobs at the expense of the environment, at the expense of farming that's nearby, at the expense of ever being able to do anything with that land, never mind getting into the reef and the effects there, that, like, you have to wonder how... Yeah, how many jobs are we creating? How much money are we actually bringing in?
The bit where the federal government's trying to bring in these laws that would have basically made the ABC journalists and, hell, admin staff at the ABC who touched any of this material, subject to 5, 10 further years in prison, depending on whether it was, you know, even more if aggravated, but just from touching it. So there have been some developments today about these terrifying anti-journalist, anti-whistleblower laws. The government is looking at reining in some of the, creating some defences for journalists potentially, because the entire, not just the ABC is annoyed with them, but News Corp is annoyed with them for having these attacks on, basically criminalising a huge part of journalism. The ABC for having those filing cabinets, not only the journalists, but even, you know, admin staff who might have touched it, would be looking at 5, 10 years or more if aggravated in prison. But the problem with that is getting the journalists off their back, getting News Corp off their back by putting some protections in for them doesn't solve the overall problem, which is, it, by going after whistleblowers, it still stops us finding out these things. Like, we need... If I became Prime Minister suddenly, one of the first bloody things I'd be doing is bringing in proper, full, comprehensive whistleblower protections. We need a Whistleblower Protection Act that makes it a full defence. We, the public, need the politicians to pass legislation that is in our interest, not theirs, so we find out what's going on. The idea that this stuff is... that stuff that's embarrassing for politicians, they can argue, therefore, is not in the national interest, because embarrassing them is not in the national interest, it weakens their position as the politicians. That's outrageous. That's exactly the sort of stuff that we should know about. So the cabinet papers, obviously, the idea of cabinet secrecy is so that in cabinet, ministers feel free to discuss things that might be embarrassing, so they don't have to be so guarded when they're discussing stuff. They can thrash out ideas, is the idea between. And so there's this long-standing principle of governments not only not releasing that information when they come in from their predecessors, but not even looking at it. Because, of course, if governments, if you know, when the Labor Party comes in, they look at what the Liberals were doing in cabinet, or vice versa, then nobody's going to ever discuss things openly in parliament, in cabinet.
Well, that's one of the reasons that when we used to send reports up that were cabinet in confidence, the idea was that they were some hard, raw numbers. So the cabinet could look at these things, you know, like they were actual real assessments. So cabinet could look at these things with honesty, and they could look at these things between them and consider what would be the best move forward.
Now, I have some reservations about that, because I think, frankly, that public servants should not be covering for politicians, and the raw numbers should be going up, and if the politicians don't like it or they're embarrassing, then bad luck. That's what goes out. But I was amused by the idea that the Liberals were attacking the ABC for releasing this cabinet stuff, when one of the things that was revealed was that when Tony Abbott called his Trade Union Royal Commission, no, sorry, not Trade Union, the Pink Bats Commission, like all of their commissions are just political bashing of their opponents.
But that one, most very specifically, it was revealed.
Yeah, he specifically... When the commission asks for the cabinet papers, he's getting all this advice from the public service saying, no, you don't do that. We protect the confidentiality of these papers even from the other party, because it's a principle that then is applied to us. And Tony Abbott was saying, nah, it goes straight off, and he gave it all over.
He's like an evil little petulant child.
But all these long stand. But this is the thing. It's so mad calling the Liberals the Conservatives, because they're really not. They are right wing partisans. They don't plan to consider. All this stuff they talk about, the great genius of Western democracy, and you've got, and we'll have a bit of, from Brandon Selig, when he's stuck in my crawl later, talking about Peter Dutton's attack on the independence of the judiciary, and we have Tony Abbott burning the idea of cabinet privilege. Like, these are people that, where it gives them a political edge, they will burn these things. The independence of the... Sorry, it's not the independence of the judiciary. We see it in Australia vs. Humanity all the time, where they, in order to avoid the courts having oversight over refugees, they just try and excise chunks of Australia so they can't. Like, these people are not conservatives. They are right-wing warriors who want power, and they want power precisely for one purpose, which is to cut taxes for the rich.
To make themselves richer.
And the people that give them money. Well, they want power and primary. So should we have a chat with some of the... I really want to cover two things in this episode before we get to Australia vs. Humanity. But we've got a number of the scary right-wing economic plans that they're pushing into this week. So everything from their how they're justifying the tax cuts through to discussion about private health, that sort of thing. And then I also want to have a chat where we talk about some of the... It's been a big week for fundamentalist right-wing men, from Barnaby to Lyle Shelton to Corey and Tasmania trying to ban abortion, so we go back to the bad old days where women have to flee across the...
Isn't it always a good week for right-wing men?
Yeah, you know it is. All right, well, let's go through the first chunk. So we look the whistleblower thing. I think we need a Whistleblower Protection Act. Batman. It'll be interesting to see what Labor decides about Adani, because they're trying to walk a bit of a tightrope there. And by the way, this I think is one of the biggest things that's idiotic about the ALP declaring war on the Greens. If the ALP is finding itself having to walk a tightrope, then do your shit that you need to do to get and let the Greens have those seats, and they will pull you, but externally. Like, the Labor Party, because it's greedily wants to have right-wing and left-wing voters, ultimately ends up standing for nothing.
And that's why they hemorrhage voters on both sides in the end.
Yeah, as they should. Meanwhile, the Greens are also pressuring Labor to reverse electricity privatisation in that seat. But all right, we found out this week that the big mining companies, who are still referred to as miners because it makes it sound like blue-collar workers. And...
Yeah, it makes it sound like it's actually, like, guys going down with, like, pickaxes on their shoulders and, yeah.
Whereas by miners they mean giant multinational
corporations
that are owned. Yeah. But apparently the federal and state environmental funding cut coincided with the industry being awarded $2.5 billion in fuel tax credits, so they receive more than twice as much in fuel tax credits as the Turnbull government will spend on environment and biodiversity programs in total this financial year. They will get more back than twice as much. I mean, that's
madness.
So investment in environmental programs was cut by 9% in the 3 years from to 2016-17. Mm-hmm. Budget spending rose by 10%. But the cuts are, they're giving $2.5 billion in fuel tax credits this year, about $980 million of which goes to coal companies.
Wow, that's madness. I know I just said that, but I don't know what else to say about it.
Well, it makes sense if you think that that all Australia can really do is farm sheep and grow and dig shit out of the ground. And that's a sustainable long-term model for the country.
That's really... It's never a sustainable long-term model.
Well, I mean, it's not, certainly not going to be a great job creator. Like, isn't this classic thing of... who was having a whinge about the idea of a four-day... Somebody proposed the four-day week again.
That was the Corbyn thing with the Daily Mail. Daily Mail was like, four-day week work weeks, a three-day jam-making weekends.
Yes. Like, they just... I love it when the Tories are so unable to attack an actual policy from a lefty that they have to make up a whole new policy.
I want a three-day jam-making weekend. That sounds awesome. The foxes will attack conservatives.
That's right. You're training foxes to attack Tories. We are losing a lot of jobs to automation. And in fact, we had some other things coming out in the America this week where they were talking about, like, I was out of Davos, that in the next, the very rich people talking to each other. And they could expect that, you know, something like a third of jobs will have disappeared in the next 10 years. And you know, 50% in the few years after that. But, I mean, that makes sense. We are going to automation, which doesn't mean that the amount of labour required is going to reduce. But the problem is that and in fact, you can look at the stats. Everything since automation came in general, I mean, people started losing jobs to automation in the 70s and 80s. Where's that gone? It hasn't gone to better living conditions for ordinary people. It's all just been, it hasn't gone to shorter working hours or greater remuneration.
Not.
It's been hoovered up into corporate profits.
In fact, it almost seems like that middle class that developed post-World War II because of the onset of semi-auto, like there was, you know, a bit of automation, there was a boom in factories, there was just a general boom in general, and this sort of middle class became a reality for the first time pretty much in forever. And this idea, that's where that idea of, you know, any person could get out of high school and work at a factory and get a good job and own a house and do all of these sorts of things. That's been fading more and more as we've over the past couple decades. And that gap, that pre sort of World War II gap of that rich and the poor, of there being like the working peon class and the wealthy class, is coming back again. It's only that other world only existed for a few generations.
And the only thing that will put it back is people getting angry about it.
Yes.
And because it's more people, there's the number of people affected outweighs the number of people who are benefiting. The number of people who are negatively affected outweighs the number of people who are benefiting. But for some, we're letting the people who are benefiting from the current system distract us because they own everything and they can direct our anger to the poor or refugees.
Exactly, and they sell us. And so they own our media and they definitely distract it. And it's one of those sayings where we've seen that, you know, the next time you're angry at the person beneath you, stop and have a good look.
Why are you working longer hours for less and less pay? It doesn't make any sense. Your productivity is way up since the 70s, 80s, but your remuneration isn't. Where is that money going? It's not disappearing.
Mm. In fact, you think you're just expected to do more work in those hours that you're there.
Which leads to arguments about, you know, why can't we afford things like universal basic income or
Proper universal healthcare.
Or proper universal healthcare. And Greg Jericho had an excellent piece this week about the Shorten's come out and said he wants to cap private health insurance rises to 2%.
Hmm.
And the
still too much.
Well, the private health industry's come out and said, "How dare you come and infect our lovely pure private market, our free market, with your filthy government regulation?" You're like, "Hang on, isn't your entire industry entirely dependent on the government punishing people who don't take you out? Like, if your market was, it's like cinemas." If people like cinemas, if cinemas are a great model for showing movies, then why is it that they have to have a monopoly on showing movies first?
Yep.
If everybody likes cinemas, then you could release movies on Blu-ray at the same time as or online at the same time as at the cinemas, and people would still go to the cinema. Of course, they don't, because it's actually a shit model and it's got to be protected. Same with private health insurance. The only reason private health insurance requires governments to have a punishment for people who don't take it out.
Well, exactly. And they, you know, and not only that, they punish you in other ways. They punish you by breaking the system. We were discussing today on Facebook that one of the things they've done is they've frozen Medicare levies, or they've frozen sort of gap payments and Medicare payment levies for a lot of fundamental services, or what I consider fundamental services, x-rays, ultrasounds, these scans that you might need to determine whether it be that you're pregnant or that you're seriously ill or that you even just have an injury. These scans that you need fewer and fewer places bulk bill these things because the co-payment, the payment they receive back from the government, has been frozen for a few years now, and it's going to stay that way.
Yeah, but hang on.
So they're getting less money for it. So the only people who can then afford to get these scans, you either have to wait forever for something that might be very necessary for you, or you end up not getting it at all.
It's almost like the private health industry model requires governments to run the public health system badly. It's almost like...
It almost exactly like that.
It's almost like if it's in their interests to make sure governments never run public health properly, because if public health is run properly, as it should, like public health is by far the most efficient way of allocating resources, because you've got the 100... It's like an insurance model where you've got... Every person is putting into it,
yes,
and every person that accesses it. It's like the full it's the full pool that you need, and it's like it's like almost if you had full decent healthcare that covered everybody, what would the private industry be for?
Exactly, we could put the same amount of money that we put into private health insurance into the public health insurance through tax, and have a much better system that covered everyone
What I'm saying more specifically is that the private industry needs governments
public
health.
Because if
they don't run it down, what do the private model, what do they have to sell?
Exactly.
The only thing they sell is, we're not as shit as the rundown system. That's what you're, when you buy private health insurance, you're not thinking you're getting something gold-plated. You're thinking, shit, I need this because the public system has been run down.
I moved to Australia when I was 28. I became a resident when I was 29. Temporary resident, but still a resident.
You were from a country that already had, like, you were already part of the sort of a
fairly comprehensive universal system. And it's not quite a two-tier system as it is here, because there's no such... You can't get private insurance for the same things.
Okay, good.
Like, your GP has to bulk bill.
In Canada?
Yes.
Okay, good.
GPs have to bulk bill. There is no
Why is that not a requirement here? That should be...
There is absolutely no way for them to for you to just get this Medicare rebate back. There is, like, anyway.
You don't pay at a doctor.
You don't pay at the doctor. You don't pay at the GP. It does mean that doctors...
Wait a minute. So do you mean that people, when they're feeling ill, get seen by a doctor quickly rather than filling up emergency rooms or having their own...
Not necessarily. There are still issues with the system. Issues with the system that include, for example, because there's a cap on how much a doctor can make in a year, like how many patients they can see, what they'll get paid, they will often cap that. So sometimes it's hard to find a doctor that's accepting patients. However, there is a lot of... there are a lot of urgent care places popping up, which are sort of like walk-in clinics, which have the same doctors on, and they're still bulk billed.
So what's the cap on there for? It's just because...
To stop doctors from just pushing people through.
Okay, that makes sense.
So the idea is that...
If there's a shortfall, though, that implies that the rate for doctors isn't high enough. Because otherwise more people would try... There'd be more doctors coming through.
There aren't enough doctors, which is part of the problem is there aren't enough medical schools.
Okay.
And people also go to the US where they can make a hell of a lot more money.
Because it's just over the border.
They
do have to live in a shithole country ruled by Trump.
Well, they do, but anyway. But there aren't enough doctors, and especially if you're somewhere rural. But the issue is, even those urgent care clinics are bulk billed. Whereas here I remember going to the one bulk bill clinic I could ever go to, you would get your quote-unquote 15-minute appointment that you're supposed to get covered by Medicare, and you'd be in and out in 30 seconds. I'd have people give me birth control pill prescriptions without checking my blood pressure or asking about my family history.
But this is the thing, people assume, therefore, that the public system, because the government, particularly right-wing governments, have an interest in running it down.
Yes.
They don't take responsibility for it. Private industry can deal with it. Like, it's much... The only interest in having a decent public system is pressure from
the public.
Ordinary people. Yeah. And if you can gradually reduce people's expectations of the public system and get
and
people
that's
to equate...
What done.
That's right. And particularly since Howard, they made a real effort to run everything down. But it's the same with the right-wing approach to government. They don't like the idea of government doing anything other than spending, you know... Hang on, how much did they agree to this week to just give to the export finance investment? So there's a government department that basically helps Australian companies export, and usually it deals with a banner of weird Australian companies. And I think they were just given $3.8 billion or something ridiculous to specifically start promoting this is Turnbull's defence thing.
Arms dealing,
yeah. Projects that wouldn't usually qualify under their criteria because they're way too speculative and bullshit.
Yes.
So this whole thing of like, we're going to make money arms dealing. First of all, we're not even going to make that money.
Yeah,
it's not just monstrous, but we're having to put huge amounts of money in.
Yeah, to make it. But one of the things that I was saying was that I moved here when I was 28. I became a resident when I was 29. And one of the things that happened when I hit 30, or just about when I hit 30, is I got this fear campaign about signing up for private health insurance. Because if I didn't sign up for private health insurance by the time I was 30, I was going to be punished for it for the rest of my life in Australia.
Yep.
It was terrifying.
It is indeed. It is what massively jumped up. I mean, Howard brought that in towards the end of... When did he bring that in? But the bottom line was there has been this huge increase in private health in Australia, but that's because, otherwise people in their 30s wouldn't do it at all because there is an absolutely rubbish. Greg Jericho wrote an excellent piece in the Guardian this week about how it's a con, how the private health market's a con. But basically, without that government mandated, what do they call it? They gave it this lovely name, lifetime health cover.
Yeah.
So this thing
in
that
July
is about punishing you with a financial penalty for the rest of your life if you don't take it out young. If you think, I will believe in the public system, I don't want to be involved in the private system, but you need it later in life because they've continued to run the system down, they force you to take it and they call it lifetime health cover. That's,
yep.
I mean, that is some spectacularly Orwellian bullshit name calling there. But yeah, that's right. So July 2000, Howard brought that in. I don't disagree with Greg saying this is to plan to blackmail people into joining private health insurance. They've done several things. So Greg points this out. So we had Medibank in 1975, and then the private health insurance market gradually fell. Before Medicare, obviously, you had to have private health insurance. Hawke government introduced Medicare in 84. Only 54% of people had private health insurance. By 97, according to Greg, it was down to 33%. So Howard then brought in a Medicare levy surcharge for everyone earning over $100,000, and a 30% private health insurance rebate in 1999, and then in July 2000, they brought in this, the lifetime health cover penalty. And that's why we've got private health insurance. I wouldn't have private health insurance otherwise. No. I don't believe in the private health market. I'm being bullied into participating in this dodgy system, this two-tier system, which has at its core the idea that screw poor people. They can just they can have their legs fall off. As long as people who can jump on board this thing can avoid the public system, we'll just let it run into the ground. Like, it's feral, but you can't, because they've done this, you can't avoid it. If you are in any way able to do it, you have to jump on board, because otherwise you run the giant risk that over the next 10, 20 years, the government will further run down the public system, and then you'll be in your 60s and suddenly need some cover, and then they're going to make it, they're going to destroy you, and you end up going to end up, you know, without a leg. I don't know. I've got some weird thing about legs falling off.
I have no idea. When I was, I got really dehydrated a couple of times when I was pregnant, and I ended up at the hospital getting fluids. And the one time this guy kept coming along and asking me, okay, but do you want this to be a private visit? Do you want, like, he was pushing me, like bullying. And when you're dehydrated and haven't slept in 2 days and are three or 4 months pregnant.
Oh, this is the hospital one. Yeah. The market is private. Yeah, because they get money, different money. But
they get more money, basically, if you say you're private.
Which is stuffed.
And I was like, no, I don't want to be private. I don't. Well, I'll just mark you down. Just you know. No, don't.
And they do the classic thing where they try and say, but if you're using the public system and you can afford the private system, then you're taking a place away from someone who can't.
Yeah, but I was only...
They're like, no, I don't think that there should be a two-tier system. All of us should be using the public health system and the public education system.
Yes.
The fact that... The only way that those models exist, and same with education, as I said before, the only way that those models exist...
is if we break the basic system.
Yeah, because if you have a decent public system for both, what are the private models selling you?
Nothing.
What have they got to sell you if the public system's good?
Yep. In Canada, it's dental and optical.
Oh, well, that's the other thing that makes no sense. Why the frick is dental not covered by Medicare? What, poor people don't need teeth? What? How have we split off oral, like, dental care from medicine? It is medicine.
Yes.
It's a diff. It's where do they think teeth reside? Like, on, in a different plane? Like, are they sort of out of phase with the rest of our bodies? And I'm sorry, we can cover it down to here.
It's really easy
and then
to become a dentist,
here,
so teeth medicine is fine. I'm joking, it's not really easy to become a dentist.
What? Why is that not covered by Medicare? That makes little to no sense. Hearing aids. Why are hearing aids not covered by Medicare? Unless you are under 18 or on a healthcare card, which means you have to be...
like the NDIS or some sort of thing.
Yeah, or like genuinely have, like, on Newstart... I don't think so. If you have any income at all, so you can be really poor, but working poor, because again, like this whole line about wages, and because we've got here too, a couple more things on wages. This was in late December, we didn't cover it at the time, but the, you know how they did the penalty rate cut, and they're like, oh, well, it'll stimulate jobs. Nah. The research coming back from University of Wollongong and Macquarie University did research on workers, and they found that there'd been no short-term increase in average weekly hours worked by employees. So penalty rate cut didn't help. Meanwhile, you've got Cormann out there. So somebody had proposed, and the Labor Party opposed this because they don't think that they should get the tax cuts in the first place. I just think the Greens oppose it as well. But there was a proposal from the people trying to sell the company tax cuts that, hey, how about we have mandate wage rises? So, so we'll get the corporate tax cuts and wage rises, and we can sort of justified on that basis. But of course the Libs aren't actually like, but calling bullshit on the on their idea that tax cuts somehow improve wages.
Yes.
Cormann says mandating wage rises in return for tax cuts would undermine the free market.
Well, the free market is shit. We need to regulate the free market.
The free market would have us all working down the mines.
Yeah.
The only reason we're not working down the mines and have any workers' conditions at all, any workplace conditions, is the unions.
Yes.
Is people unionising, organised labour, which of course we saw last week with the Sydney trains, have been destroyed. There's another excellent Australian politics podcast called the Buena Vista Social Club, which a bunch of lefties chatting about this stuff. And they had somebody from the unions on this week. And as I pointed, one of the things I was talking about is how mad it is that the word union has been, like, connected in our brains with thugs on, you know, big thugs in hy-vis bullying people and shutting the country down. Whereas unions are the only pushback we really have against the corporate sector that is quite openly, like, it's not a conspiracy theory to say that their aim is to drive wages down.
Mm.
That's not a conspiracy. That's precisely what they're designed to do. And what do you think will happens if you drive, if you've got one side that really needs to grind wages down and you take away all the power of workers to unionise and actually push back on that? What do we think's going to happen? And it's bloody short-sighted, because obviously the upshot of that is that you have people who don't have any, a vast bulk of workers won't have any money. So how are the economy is going to function when people can't buy stuff?
Absolutely.
Well,
and that's the thing. And again, this is one of those things that gets me, is that I often look at, in the cafe or at work, the things like the Herald Sun. And it just seems that the very people buying the Herald Sun are the very people that the Herald Sun is doing the biggest disservice to by beating up unions and by beating up a lot of these, like, any sort of having a social safety network by...
Yeah, because the Herald Sun isn't trying to serve them. The Herald Sun is trying to sell... Its purpose is to sell right-wing policy to the poor on behalf of the rich.
Like,
it tricks them into thinking it's on their side, but that's what propaganda does.
Is it wrong that I feel like it should be better, like that I want it to be better?
Yes, but no. I mean, we need it to be better. We need to be fine. Part of the point of doing a podcast like this and talking about this stuff is trying to figure out ways that we push back, because it doesn't happen by itself. By itself, we have a system where money will just accumulate more and more. The people with money will accumulate more and more power and rules to themselves, and it'll be at the expense of everybody else. Like, why are wages so low if productivity has massively increased over the last decades? Like, we are producing a lot more for the fewer hours. Why have none of the benefits of that come to workers? Why do we have people who are working full-time who are basically... pay packet to pay packet. If their car hits a cockatoo on the way back from the bloody country again, and or run over a kangaroo on the Hume, or any of the other things that Australia's suicidal bloody wildlife seems intent on doing hypothetically to people this week, who may or may not be me, people who
may or may not.
Yes. Huge chunk of Australia is immediately wrecked if something like that happens, because they can't pay even if they're insured, they can't pay the insurance excess to fix it. Like, this is, people are living pay packet to pay packet, and whilst working 40-hour weeks. That is mad. There is this idea that, under socialism, you're just going to remove the incentive. We're not going to produce anything. People are just paying each other from nothing. Like, where's the stuff that they're... But the point is, we're still making the stuff. We're still doing the stuff. It's just that none of the benefits of that stuff are flowing back to ordinary people.
But also, how many people do work in jobs where they don't, quote-unquote, make anything? Where they are performing a service or... anyway. My brain hurts.
Meanwhile, Cormann's coming out. So our finance minister has this fantasy. We don't... This is about the idea of mandating wage rises. We don't support that sort of government intervention. Sorry, I need to do my Arnie Terminator voice, but it's probably a bit racist, so I shouldn't. We don't support that sort of government intervention in the Australian market. The way that everybody has the best possible way to get ahead is by supporting the free market, free enterprise, and reward for effort. Except that our system doesn't do that.
Oh, God, merit. The idea of a meritocracy is so messed up and broken and doesn't actually work. There is no such thing as a meritocracy.
Forcing companies to increase wages risks the government's getting the decision wrong and increasing the level of unemployment. They're trying to sell us that the idea of a job at which you cannot stay alive is better than having jobs being well remunerated, so that if you're working, you're at least able to survive. This whole, it feels to me like the big con is that they're very good at playing off workers against other workers. So train drivers are going to get a pay rise. How fucking dare they? I haven't had a pay rise for ages. Public servants are getting a pay rise. Oh, I haven't had a pay rise. Yeah, but your Muppets, as wages go up in one sector of the economy, it pushes them up everywhere. We should all, as workers, be celebrating every time other workers get more money. It pushes us all up. The people who, the thing that it takes that money from is company profits. Too much of the benefits of the productivity going to corporate profits. They need to be coming back to actual people.
Exactly. And that's the thing. The profits don't need to go into the companies, not at the level that they're doing.
When Centrelink goes up, you know what Centrelink going up does? As a low, if you're a low paid worker, do you know what Centrelink that going up does?
It means puts more money into the economy because people with low incomes spend nearly 100% of their income on everything. And so currently all of that money is going towards pretty much rent and accommodation, with very little left to go into the economy to be spent on things like food and the occasional going out to a movie. Like, but it builds
stuff
the economy.
That actually keeps the economy
clothes,
going.
The things that we spend on. Yeah, you increase that and people have more disposable income. But people on Centrelink still don't have enough, still not have enough money to actually save anything. You give money to a rich person, what do? They put it with their other money.
Or take it to Cayman Islands and offshore.
Well, exactly. They put it with their other money and put it in a pile and pet it, and they don't spend it.
But that's a more oblique thing. That's like how it flows back through the economy. The other one I was going to point out about Social Security going up. If the safety net is comprehensive and decent, do you know what that does to companies? They have to pay better than shit.
True.
Because otherwise, if you have an option of I can go on Centrelink, if we get rid of work for the dollar and that shit, if we have a proper safety net, which is there, universal basic, you're not going to starve to death. If you're not working, you're not going to starve to death. You won't live luxuriously, but it's a base. Then companies who want you to work have to pay you a decent wage.
Yeah, I have a few friends who are single mothers who are having that problem with Centrelink right now, that they, you know, found part-time work. But the part-time work, if they work more than the tiniest nominal amount of hours, it's not worth it for them. Like, they actually end up making less money than they would have if they just stayed on Centrelink as a single mom.
Yes, because the effective tax rate on people doing any work from Centrelink is enormous. Because for every dollar you earn, you lose 50%.
And it's madness. Like, you should be.
But the government's going to say to that, "Oh, that's all right. We'll just remove it faster."
Oh God, it's horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Or more importantly, we'll continue to make Social Security we'll cut so many holes in the safety net that you don't have that as an option. You have to go back to shitty unpaid work. But because they want people working 40 hours. For Centrelink money.
Yes. But the other thing that you provide is you provide good security, which provides good mental health, which provides having that security and knowing that safety net is there, knowing that you might not starve, and knowing that you don't have to, you know, budget every single penny, knowing that there is something there for you to fall back on, also leads to better mental health, leads to a happier, more well-adjusted community in the long run.
It leads to you being able to call bullshit when you're being exploited. It leads to you, if you are being sexually harassed or bullied at work, it leads to you being able to say nope. It leads to you be able to actually enforce some of your workplace rights without the risk of starvation.
Oh, yeah, I know so many people who have put up with really shitty workplace conditions because they might lose the job, and if they lost the job, they'd be screwed.
Yep. And you know what else it does? It enables people. You know how they've got the right-wing capitalists have this fantasy about entrepreneurs. The country needs more entrepreneurs, people who can go out there and try new things and you know, try them and maybe they'll fail. If we have a safety net, people can try things without, because failure doesn't mean starving.
Yep.
But if the consequence of stuff failing is that you die. Anyway, Greg's written another excellent piece in The Guardian about the problem with wages growth. So clearly, more and more people are recognising that wages growth being so low is a problem, except for corporate Australia, which quite likes that. So corporate Australia's version through the Libs is give us tax cuts and more money to us and it'll throw. That's how you get wages growth.
Even though all the evidence ever in the history of capitalism says otherwise.
Yes. And then obviously from the Labor side, it is wages growth is a consequence of the current employment settings. Labor isn't going very hard. The Labor Party is built by the union movement. That's where it's from. Yeah. And yet they have managed, the conservative media have managed to turn that into an insult where Labor
a dirty
shies
secret.
From it.
Yeah.
And so what they need to do, which is fix the freaking Fair Work Commission and re-implement some of the bloody protections that workers did have and don't now. The idea that Sydney Trains couldn't bloody strike, get stuffed.
Yeah, when they met, very strict regulations and requirements. But also the idea that that the no mandatory overtime ban was overruled. So they were saying that they had a no overtime ban. They had an overtime ban. So no overtime was being worked. And that was overturned as well as the strike by the commission. And it's so frustrating because if your overtime is mandatory, if it is required overtime, it's not overtime. it's not voluntary. It's not excess.
And even the this apparently socialist plan from Labor to cap health insurance premium rises at 2% for 2 years.
It's still massive. That's still a huge increase.
That's still faster than wage growth.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. So the other by the way, I just wanted to flag this whole idea that you give. Had Trump's celebrate trying to claim that he's doing so well for the economy purely on the basis that the Dow Jones is up.
Mm.
Well, I had a massive crash last week. It did bounce back a bit later, but the bottom line is it's got nothing to do with what the
that extra $1.50 a week you take home.
So the one last thing I wanted to flag about this mad approach to the corporate world and public services and the safety net was the news that this week. The Australian government is giving $430,000 to an American consultancy to tell them how to improve Centrelink's call centre.
Wow.
Hire more staff.
So if a person in the Centrelink call centre probably makes about $60,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. They're going to be in Serco. Serco, the dodgy bastards who ran down the offshore processing services. Serco, oh my goodness, you look up Serco, Google Serco scandals. Serco are this terrifying, I'm not saying you do it, don't worry, we don't have time for getting onto the other stuff, but anybody listening who's wondering who Serco is, Serco are a dodgy, dodgy multinational who run prisons and offshore detention centres, and yeah, you don't want them running Centrelink. And remember that part of what happened with the Centrelink call times is that the government was using really, really rubbery figures where, like, if they disconnected a call, it counted, or they transferred it to a new section, it counted as a new call, so they say it's answered faster. They were doing weird stuff.
They electronically tagged criminals. Oh, wow.
No, you're looking up Serco.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'll stop now.
So the government has announced they're bringing in Serco to help operate it. The $430,000 went to Brad Cleveland Company LLC, a US-based consultancy. What the bloody hell do they think that they're going to learn? Like, who's... $430,000.
Yeah. Oh, and the National Audit Office has already recommended the addition of 1,000 staff.
Yeah. So we already know what the problem is, that they cut too many staff.
So basically what they want this consultancy to come in and say is, okay, so if you restructure and make it a bit more agile, then you'll be able to maximize on the staff that you have and it'll be better.
I love that the minister, the Human Services Minister, Michael Keenan, is saying Labor cut jobs. They slashed the department's average staffing level and caused call wait times to balloon. Hang on. So you recognise that slashing staffing is what caused the call wait times to balloon. Isn't the solution obvious? Not $430,000 obvious. It's undo that thing?
Mm.
Like, how can you say the call wait times are because the staff numbers were slashed by Labor, but we don't know how to fix it? How are you in government? Isn't there...
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, this is a government that will happily throw money around as long as it doesn't go to a poor person.
Yes.
All right. Now let's talk.
In fact, if it goes to punish a poor person, they will double down on it.
Oh, that's the one thing that annoys me most about right wing is that they will happily spend, you know, $20 to grab $10 from a poor person. We saw that with the hideous robot debt. Mm. It's still going.
Yes.
Sorry, just a flag to anybody who's coming to this late. Robodebt, the thing where Centrelink just asserts that people have debts and starts demanding them back. Huge debts that are usually wrong.
Yes.
And they're usually wrong because for one reason, I mean, there's lots of reasons why they're usually wrong, but the big one is that if you have
the
declared...
The data matching algorithm is fucked up.
Yeah, because if you've declared that you worked for, you know, Jim's Bakery, but actually it's registered as...
Jim Smith Pty Limited.
Yeah. Then Centrelink goes, oh, you didn't tell us about that other job. You must have been working there. You've got a giant debt. It's so dumb. Mm. Oh, and the other thing is that they don't average over the year. So, like, you're declaring your... they are averaging over the year. So you're declaring on a fortnightly basis what you earned, what you received.
Yes.
And then they look at the tax return for the whole year or the income for the whole year and they go, oh, well, I'll just average that over the whole time. Those aren't compatible reporting systems. Anyway. It's mad. So let's talk about right-wing men being crappy. And I suppose we should probably start with Barnaby. Barnaby's love child, and the lovely, the fact that the day after he got his, he came back in the by-election, and although people kind of knew about it, the media kind of sat on the story. So he had an affair with a staffer who was his staffer at the time, and is having a child with her, at the same time as being a man who fought against LGBTI equality and the private lives of LGBTI people by saying, you know,
traditional marriage. Well,
and he wants his four daughters to have the chance to meet a man who'll protect them. From what? Like he protected their mother?
He is doing the very traditional thing of having a midlife crisis and dating and impregnating a woman who is in a power differential and age differential relationship to him. That's a very traditional thing.
Yes, that is true. That is a traditional form of marriage.
What I'd like to know is, how is Barnaby going to balance new parenthood and being in Parliament? I mean, didn't he know that there was a pregnancy before he ran and not tell us? What is he going to do about his parental leave? Like, I don't know that he can manage being a parent and being in Parliament.
Well, he's Deputy Prime Minister. I mean, that's a job that with a lot of responsibility. What if his new baby gets sick?
I know. What if he has to stay home and what if he's on an important call about picking up some formula for on the way home and he misses a vote?
So I think that the people of New England really needed the opportunity before the election to know, not just that he'd had an affair, but know that he was going to be a father during the next term.
Because that changes everything.
It might change his ability to do the job.
What if he wants to work part-time? What if he wants flexible work arrangements?
Mm.
There's so many things that would normally be asked of a woman or said. In fact, we can see that pretty much every single one of those things has been said about Jacinta Ardern.
Can Barnaby Joyce manage both a career and a family?
I just don't know.
I mean, he did previously because he had his wife that he's abandoned raise his four daughters for him and also build his career.
That's right. He used his political staffer, well, not his political staffer, his wife, sorry. He used his wife as pretty much a staff member in order to raise his family so he could have his political career.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It feels to me like if, because have you seen all the photos of him with his four daughters and his wife, like, parade? Like, he used his family to promote himself, basically.
Yes.
So it feels like the voters of New England should have known that had changed.
Yeah, it does, it does. It feels like he's the sort of man who wants to have it all. A career, a family, a second family. Oh.
Can men really manage to have two families and keep their career and keep their families happy?
I don't know. Who will make dinner?
Cathy McGowan's now proposing that there should be a bit of a ban on workplace relationships between MPs and staffers. And there is a pretty major power differential there. That is quite problematic.
Absolutely.
The other aspect is, well, there's two other aspects. Obviously, there's the hypocrisy one, given that he ran the family values thing to attack LGBTI people and was like, no, it's just my private life, he's saying now, but he didn't care about attacking their private lives.
No, you're right. He doesn't mind attacking other people's private lives. He doesn't mind sitting there saying horrible things about LGBTIQIA people. He basically, that's fine. But what gets me is that this was this big secret, right? This the worst kept secret in Canberra, and all the people have said that. And again, if it was a woman in power, I believe that it probably would have been trotted out.
Well, we saw how they attacked Julia Gillard for not having, for being childless and all those
things.
So, like,
and wasn't she not married as well? Like, she was her partner?
So there's lots of innuendo there.
Yeah.
The press gallery didn't go too hard on it. It was sort of more on the fringes. And I certainly don't want us to make people's politicians private life. Because the bottom line, and fundamentally in terms of Barnaby, if Barnaby had not cheated on his wife, and he had stayed in that relationship and they'd lived according to the principles that he says he espouses, it still doesn't mean that his advocacy against LGBTI people was right.
No.
Like, it's still bad.
Absolutely
irrespective
not.
Of who he is and what he does privately, his argument was shit.
His argument was horrible and discriminatory. It just makes it also hypocritical.
Well, I suppose the idea is if conservatives, if you can't even live according to your rules, why are you out there espousing that?
Yes.
But then again, because you fail on a difficult rule doesn't mean that the rule is wrong. Like, I mean, their argument might be, yeah, I failed. I'm human and fallible. Doesn't mean we shouldn't aspire to more. It doesn't mean
that I can't discriminate against LGBTQIA people.
Well, say it was a different moral thing that was actually morally wrong, like theft or something, and then they've railed against theft, and then they get caught doing a theft. It doesn't mean that their campaign against theft was wrong. Like, campaign against theft was always correct. It's just that they turned out to be
a thief
themselves. A thief. Sorry, that's not a good example because theft is not a genuine human failing. But you know, I suppose you could argue that having high standards and then failing to live up with them doesn't mean... The problem is that what they were defining as high standards was shit, whether or not they lived up to them or not. But the problem isn't that.
The problem is that he is a person in a position of power who is espousing a certain way of life as being correct at the detriment of other people. And
at the same time, it's not like he later fell down.
Yeah,
like,
no.
At the time he was doing it, he knew that he was currently...
Exactly.
And had just been... Yeah.
And he was... That's the thing. So he was in a position of power and he was using that platform and that power to espouse a certain way of life that he was failing at to the detriment of other people that he was cutting down and hurting through what he was saying while he was failing at it. And that's where it gets me. But you also, there's so many layers of this. There's the idea that, well, he really went from one political staffer to another, didn't he? He had his wife who put her career on hold and supported him and didn't work for those years so he could get into politics. And then he found a new poop. So she's roughly, you know, she worked for him basically.
I would expect that whatever resources they have in the family law property settlement, Barnaby's ex-wife will be...
Yes, that will be acknowledged. She's in a situation where that is a thing. They are a wealthy family. They do have these things. What about all the women who support their partner and when the marriage breaks down like that, don't have that money? There isn't a family pool to get. Why don't women get super paid via the government or something while they're on maternity leave and raising the family? Why? Or fathers who are at home doing the same thing and take breaks from their careers. Why do we value that so little? Like, there's all sorts of...
Well, because it's not so much that, it's more who should pay it.
But there's all sorts of questions. Anyway.
Well, there's also other questions about whether there were taxpayer funds spent transporting a new person around. But then again, they have family allowances, so it's... Look, I'm not... I have no particular beef with people having different relationship structures. I do have a problem with people cheating on other people, but human beings are weak and dickheads. I have a giant problem with... I think the issue about with staffers is problematic because it is a workplace and it would impact on other workers, even if it was entirely consensual between them. But he's the deputy prime minister. Like,
he has a lot of power and there's a big age differential and it just squicks me out.
I don't like the Daily Telegraph running a picture of a paparazzi shot of her on the front page. She's not a public figure. She should be out of it. I don't like that. It's weird. It's been weirdly kindly dealt with in a way, particularly by the Murdoch press, in a way that they never would.
Well, that's what I mean. They would never have dealt with Julie that way or a woman that way, I think, or even someone from a different party that way.
I suppose it's weird, though, we're now entering into an era, and obviously the Trump thing with Stormy Daniels and things, is like male politicians appear to be, that even conservative ones who are declaring that they believe in these things. In fact, especially conservative ones appear to be unable to be brought down by these sorts of things that previously would have been, you know, a big thing that they had to pay. Trump tried to hush it up.
Yeah.
Like, previously, these things were giant electoral liabilities, and now it appears that people we've just assumed that powerful men will be assholes.
Well, speaking of powerful men who are assholes.
What a segue.
Oh, I thought it was.
Which one? We've got Corey, we've got Lyle.
Let's talk with Lyle. Good old Lyle, who is leaving. Who has left his beloved Christian lobby.
Oh, I don't know. He's left his job for them. He's probably still a member of them or something. So he can run for Parliament. For Corey's Australian Conservatives in Queensland. Is he running for the Senate in Queensland? I look forward to him bringing the same level of success to that campaign as he has to his previous political campaigns, including his attempts to run for Parliament previously and also his fighting against LGBTI people, which, of course, he lost badly.
Hooray!
But it kind of highlights what he was doing. Basically, this is a man who said as much horrible stuff as he could against LGBTI people to build a profile. Every time we participated in arguing with him, it didn't really switch any people. Didn't have much. Well, no, it did do enough harm and switch people on the fence to get them scared about. But yeah. His attacks on trans people did make people who would have supported LGBTI, or sorry, gay people who didn't really know any trans people. It did switch them to being nasty to trans people. So he has had a genuine effect in increasing anti-trans hatred in the country. So thanks a lot for that. But the second part of it is he was mainly building himself a political profile. So the more we argue with him, the more he built that profile.
Last year, during the marriage campaign, I felt very drawn to the political side of things, to the partisan side of politics.
But remembering, of course, that he has run previously. Like, he's always been a partisan politician. So what he's done is he's used the ACL to get himself a national profile that he can hopefully, in his mind, wrangle into
I'm not leaving the battles for the values that you and I hold dear. I'm going to a different part of the battlefield.
Yes.
It's eloquent prose. I'm convinced I'm going to move to Queensland and not vote for him.
Well, I get him switching from lobbying outside to...
Absolutely.
..to being... I mean, but...
But you're right. It does feel that what he did for the ACL and why he made himself so much the focus of what he did for the ACL, because that was the thing. It wasn't just that he was running this hateful, hate-filled campaign for the ACL. It's that he was running it, that it was his face, him mentioning it. He was the news as much as anything else.
I think the ACL should feel a bit used, to be honest. He's kind of nicked off and they left them with... So Martin Miller's from there. I like... What's they call it? The human rights... It's like their... something like their Human Rights Law Centre or something. They've got something where they're fighting for human rights... What they define as human rights, which, of course, aren't human rights. And, in fact, actually, I wanted to read out to you... This is how they describe the attacks... On what they see as human rights. And this is the sort of stuff that Martin Illis, the new ACL head, has been running these things. And in fact, this is actually him talking about his new role. Now, see if you can pick out, like, let me give you the coy terms that they use. So you won't be able to pick out from this what it is that the people involved actually said or did, because he doesn't give you that. This is what he says to his people. These chilling cases include, in South Australia, a university student was suspended after praying with a friend. That sounds completely innocuous. Praying with a friend? Why? Who gets arrested for? Who gets suspended for praying with? There's something else in that story, isn't there?
Yes.
In New South Wales, new church plants were threatened with eviction from rented halls because activists object to online sermon content. Weirdly, he doesn't say what that online sermon content was, does he? In Tasmania, multiple clergy are being hauled before anti-discrimination bodies for teaching the Bible. Really? They taught that, you know, Jesus was the Son of God and oh, wait, there's something specific that they were teaching in there, wasn't
they? They were teaching hate speech.
In Victoria, medical and health professionals had their professional qualifications threatened because of their faith.
Oh, is that the anti-vaxxer people?
Who knows? Like this is... They are... He's specifically...
Or is that like the, oh no, I was thinking New South Wales. That was the New South Wales woman who had hers threatened because she was pro-conversion camps for gay kids.
In Western Australia, a Christian couple have been told they cannot be foster parents because of their biblical views on sexuality. Reading between the lines, because they want to teach kids that gay people are bad.
Yep.
In New South Wales, a university lecturer was subjected to investigation because of talks they had given in churches and Christian schools. Talks. That sounds
interesting, though.
That sounds completely innocent, doesn't it?
I find it very interesting that they use the singular they there. Because they don't want to identify the gender of that lecturer. They use the singular they.
It's
funny,
coy,
but they make such a big thing about the use of the singular they for people who, you know...
For trans people.
Or non-binary or intersex or people who...
How revealing is that? This is an email from the ACL to its supporters. And they don't feel that their supporters can have the detail because even they think their supporters will call bullshit on it. So they have to do this euphemism for teaching the Bible because of their faith, because of their biblical views on sexuality, because of talks. But people aren't locked up because they give talks. They're not subjected to... subjected to investigation. It wasn't like...
Yep.
Anyway. But you could say the same thing if these people were Nazis and they were out there calling for Jews to be murdered. You could say these same things. Oh, well, these people, a university lecturer was subjected to investigation because of talks they had given in churches and Christian schools. That could be a Nazi declaring they should burn down synagogues or something. Oh, just talks they were given. Like, there is any amount of hate speech and damaging hate speech that is indefensible that they cover up with euphemisms like,
yep,
because of their faith, because of talks. Objected to online sermon content. What was that online sermon content?
Yeah, absolutely. It could have been, oh, God.
How revealing is it, though, that even amongst friends, they feel that they have to be coy about what it is that they actually did?
It is terrifying.
Bloody revealing. All right, so Lyle's new mates at the Australian Conservatives, Corey, specifically Corey and Lyle got on really well during the No campaign. Corey had some weird attack on midwives that I think fired you up this week.
Yes. Yeah, basically, Corey Bernardi sent out an email this week.
It's his weekly common sense email that he sends out on Wednesdays that if you really hate yourself, you can sign up to.
And some of us really hate ourselves.
I apparently loathe everything about myself because I've been getting it for a while.
Basically, what's happened is there's a new code of conduct for midwives developed last year, which references the concepts of cultural safety. And in which case, there's a secondary part of it, which the Congress of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Nurses and Midwives talk about the safety that people have and that they have a practice based on dialogue, communication, power sharing and negotiation, and the acknowledgement of white privilege. They acknowledge that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, in specific, are at a disadvantage, that they have poor health outcomes, and that one of the ways that you can get them a better health outcome is to acknowledge the privilege that you have with them, or to consider your privilege when treating them.
Okay. But you're looking at outcomes.
Yes.
Oh, right. But I'm fairly sure that the conservative approach to any kind of recognition of these sorts of things is about...
But the idea is
outcome immune.
I don't care that
injecting rooms get better at health outcomes. It makes me feel like you're legalizing drugs, so it's bad.
Yes. The idea is that at this point in their life, a midwife or a nurse midwife, who is supposed to be your conduit and your connection to the medical profession, which... especially for a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, can often seem not there for them, distant to them, closed to them, that they're supposed to be your connection, they're supposed to be your safety. And they're talking about creating a safe space for people who traditionally have poor health outcomes.
Okay, that seems perfectly sensible.
Yeah, right? And they say that coming at it with this effect has much better. It puts people in a safer place.
So what's Corey's problem with it?
And so the Nursing and Midwifery Board of Australia went one further and said that they should, for anyone of a different race, consider this thing.
Okay, sounds reasonable.
Basically, Corey has sent out this newsletter, which he referred to it as, yes, apparently the new medical Marxism, the brave new world of nursing. We're catering to other self-declared victimhood and catering to their emotional whims and fantasies is as important as fixing their physical ailments. So instead of, you know...
If we really want to fix what's wrong with elements of our society, we would stop indulging this garbage.
Basically, what this says is, what the code actually says is that they engage with women as individuals in a culturally safe and respectful way. It will foster open, honest, and compassionate professional relationships and adhere to their obligations about privacy and confidentiality. And by doing this, nurses and midwives will provide leadership in building a health system free of racism and inequity and one that is equally accessible to everybody.
Well, you can see why Corey's got a problem with all those things.
So Corey stated in his letter that basically a person in labor could declare that a nurse has to declare their white privilege in the room. They have to declare their white privilege. They have to announce it. I have white privilege. And if they don't, they can be asked to leave the room. And stop.
Well, first of all, I'm sure that's not what it says. And secondly, why would anybody do that?
Right. You can acknowledge that you benefit from a system. So this is what Corey says. Let's consider a few enduring truths. having a baby hasn't really changed over generations. Okay. Well, I would say that even a very few generations it has, because of the increased use of hospitals, the increased use of anesthesia, sanitation. There's a number of ways that, you know, microsurgery, there's a number of ways it's changed.
I mean, I'm sure Corey would be perfectly happy with, mortality and childbirth rates going back a couple of decades or centuries.
Or to where they are in the US. Absolutely. It can be painful, difficult, sometimes dangerous, but it is entirely necessary for our species to continue. It's the same process for every woman, regardless of race, creed, or color. Through time immemorial, others have been there to assist in bringing new life in the world, and no one has had to acknowledge white privilege until March 2018. That's when the new rules and regulations of the Midwifery Association kick into gear, forcing the committed midwife into a chamber of political correctness.
If that was the case, Corey, you would imagine that midwives would be angry about it. But yeah. They're not, because it's not that at all, and you're talking shit.
And most midwives are very... People get into midwifery because they care about women and childbirth. They want to be...
Possibly women's health outcomes,
yes,
which is the indication is that that would actually help.
Dear, what... Oh, what are you thinking? Yes, exactly. And increasing and having better health outcomes. But the idea that in his thing is that cultural safety is now deemed as important as clinical safety, the highest of priorities. As such, transgressions can be expected to be treated harshly.
That's total bullshit.
It is bullshit, but it's also, I actually kind of hope it was. Like, we ran into some casual racism at some of our induction classes, our parenting classes.
Oh, yeah, yeah, at the hospital.
And, you know, we wrote in a comment... Because we wrote in a comment that we found it inappropriate and that the example that she gave about it being, oh, you know, she was a loud Greek or Italian woman, or I think it was a Greek woman. And
they were playing on a bunch of racial stereotypes that were a bit
exactly
weird and not very helpful. And if you were from those groups, I imagine we are, you know, white privileged middle class people, but I imagine if you're from those groups, you would find it quite, being shoved into those boxes, quite restrictive and intimidating.
Yeah. And so we, you know, left a note about how we felt it inappropriate because it didn't really, we found it bothersome, but it didn't really affect us. We probably should have spoken up about it at the time, and we didn't, and that was our failing. However, for people who are constantly disadvantaged and constantly coming up against the system and constantly coming up against casual racism as well as ingrained racism as well as overt racism, having a situation where those transgressions are dealt with harshly is important. Anyway,
but that's not even what's being proposed. So there is
it's just to be respectful and to consider where the people you're treating are coming from.
And that's why but that's the bottom line. Conservatives don't want us to be respectful of people who are not white men. Every time they attack political correctness, mm-hmm. that's all political correctness is, treating people with respect.
Yes.
They are saying, I don't want to have to respect people who are not like me.
Yes.
That's all it is. Fundamentally,
yes.
That's why whenever they ask to respect people who are not like them, they kick up a stink and cry like they have a little tantrum. While we're talking about terrible fundamentalist men, the Tasmanian Premier Will Hodgman, so just before the March election, have announced that they are going to block access to state-funded abortion. So the last clinic in Tasmania that did abortions shut down in January. They are going to prevent... they're going to block access to state funding. So basically it'll be back to the old days where, you know, for Tasmanian women, going to the mainland for the weekend was a euphemism for having an abortion.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Now,
this is like that thing in Ireland where people had to go to, like, London, to go to England to get an abortion.
Which causes real harm. First of all, it means that poor people, is a real problem on poor women who don't want to, who want to have an abortion, who don't want to...
But also, if you have any health complications, but you
it's
can't...
It's bad for travelling.
Yeah, oh, God.
Yeah, that's appalling. And the other one, while we're talking about, so two other things, we've got Jim Mullen, the senator who had been retweeting or resharing on Facebook anti-Muslim memes from Britain First, but according to Malcolm Turnbull, he doesn't have a racist bone in his body, so that's fine.
No, he has a racist shirt that he wears every day.
Well, I'm not going to say anything about Jim Mullen because... Adam Bant made some remarks about him in Fallujah, and he is suing him.
He's threatening to sue him
for defamation, even though he's apologized.
Well, so, his apology lacked any sort of contrition, and he wants him to try again.
No, I'd like you to crawl a bit more. Now, one other thing that's disturbing me greatly is the... before we leave fundamentalist men's corner, Philip Roddick's Religious Freedom Review. Now... Depending on when you're listening to this, and hopefully it's tomorrow, being Friday, You only have until the start of next week to put in your submission. So Google Religious Freedom Review and put in a submission, even if it's short, even if it's just, I don't see why religious people should have privileges over to take away the basic rights of other citizens. We don't want a sectarian country where people are being sacked because of their religious beliefs and have to keep their religious beliefs and practices private, or their sexual their partner's secret because otherwise they'll get sacked, like the Catholic Church threatened to do. Please put in your submission to that. The new one of the new scary bits out of it today was the news that not only are they having submissions, keeping submissions suppressed, they are also having secret hearings. Now, LGBTI activists have sounded these alarms because they're unadvertised, they're unrecorded, quote, informal dialogues, which are massively hostile to LGBTI people.
Oh, God, that's terrifying.
Ruddock brushed off concerns that the process of private hearings reduces transparency, telling Guard, this is a review, a government review, and they are having unrecorded, private, secret, like, what? How does this review have any credibility at all? But he told Guardian Australia it's not a trial, and the panel's more likely to be persuaded by written submissions anyway. More likely, but they still have some impact, or why are you doing them?
Yeah.
And, like, that's like courts having secret, like, you don't...
Look, we'll just have an informal session in front of a magistrate. We won't have any recording of it. We'll have a few decisions, and you can walk away.
The Guardian Australia, so it was an email account attended of the first hearing in... the ACT on Monday, where the ACT's LGBTIQ Ministerial Advisory Council Chair Anne-Marie Delahunt and a member, Suzanne Eastwood, were present. She wrote to her fellow members of the council that she and Delahunt were alarmed, to say the least, about the type of questioning and the complete lack of a, quote, friend on the panel. The negative effects this review could have on our community are quite alarming. It felt like progress could be set back years and years. We were asked not to discuss the discussion we had at the review.
Keep the secret secret.
Labor's saying that these private hearings will undermine confidence in the process. No shit. How this is not a parliamentary committee. It's not, doesn't have any full it's quite opaque. It's really dodgy. And yet,
but
the government,
they're going to use it. They're going to use it. They're going to hold it up and say, "But we had this review."
Yeah. With a shitty process that we can't review the review.
Can you tell us about the review? Yes, we had it.
That said, make your submissions. Make sure that they are marked, that they should be public. Everybody gets something in.
Yes,
and we'll absolutely. You'll be able to check whether your thing actually got put out or not. Don't worry. There's no doubt that they'll be getting lots of submissions from the ACL types. They are campaigning. If you're getting the ACL emails, they are campaigning really, really hard on getting all their people to click on buttons in their forms to hear what we want to send. So this review will be getting a huge amount of material from the people who want to undo what just happened.
Yes.
Who want to take away the few rights that LGBTI people just gained, let alone doing what really needs to happen, which is remove some of the religious privileges that still exist, like the ability to sack people for being gay. Now, Brandon Zellick is going to have some commentary on this terrifying new news that Peter Dutton wants to... So what Peter Dutton is saying is he wants potential court appointees' names to be released publicly so that the public can debate about it, which is sort of like a quasi-public review of judges, which takes us down the American path of electing judges, which is a massive
madness.
Step backwards. So Brandon Selleck, we're letting us know now what is stuck in his craw.
Hello all, and Jeremy, thanks for having me back for this stuck in my craw. For the second time in as many months, the Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton has been rebuked by the Law Council of Australia for further criticism of this country's judiciary. At the beginning of February, Dutton said in a radio interview with 2GB that there should be greater scrutiny around appointments of magistrates and proposed that state government should publish lists of potential appointments to the court for public feedback. Now, I already think that's a bad idea. I hope you do too, but fortunately we're not the only ones. Law Council of Australia President Maurie Bales argued that such a move would risk politicising the judiciary. Now, following that thread, it would in turn threaten its independence and impartiality. Now, additionally, Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus has also criticised Dutton's statements and went on to state that if Dutton was talking about the direct election of judges, that proposal was probably unconstitutional. Now, at the very least, Dutton's suggestions, if put into practice, would violate the doctrine of the separation of powers in Australia. Now, if you're drawing a blank on what that is, Google it. Which actually might be good advice for the current federal government, now I think about it. Judges being appointed to make decisions based on what is politically popular is not a good idea, and I'd include extreme left or right-wing leaning ideas in that. Judgments must be made on the facts of the case and the law as it is written. Anything else could threaten the rule of law and our notions of justice as a society. Now, I'm also not so naive to believe that our current system is perfect. Any human system is flawed because it is subject to the whims of the human condition. But I still believe in the system, and there are checks and balances in place, such as appeals, to deal with incorrect decisions by the judiciary. An appeal is the appropriate way to criticize the judiciary and the decisions that it makes, not the media. And I think it's clear, examining Dutton's actions in his various roles in the current federal government, what kind of people he would want in judicial roles. Put simply, those who would be tough on crime, which you haven't learned by now, is a meaningless soundbite. Incarcerating people with harsher penalties does not cure any social ills, and only creates more in the long run. Coupled with other incidents, such as the recent potential threats to the freedoms of journalists in this country, these continuing attacks on the judiciary by the current federal government show a flagrant disregard for civil liberties here, and a seeming desire to silence dissent. This is the politics of fear at work, and we, as citizens, can do better than this. And that's what's stuck in my craw.
From my point of view, the problem with populist nonsense on law and order stuff is that you always make the problems worse, because what seems like a satisfying approach, punish the bad people, longer sentences, fewer protection, like, it's really easy to portray, and people assume that if somebody's charged with a crime, they're probably guilty of it. You go down the American path of massively reducing the protections that we need for in the criminal justice system.
What is that idea of the judiciary being separate?
Yeah. Well, I suppose you could argue that if they're elected, they in fact have some independent authority over Parliament.
But if they're elected, they have to campaign.
That's right. And then you have judges doing things in their courts, not for the purpose of good justice, but for appearing...
To win public... Exactly. And that's where you get people like, well, I'm tough on crime. I sentenced so-and-so many criminals to this, and I put these people in... And that's actually where a lot of those areas are where people end up the worst, where people with petty crimes and people who are poor and disadvantaged end up getting harsher sentences in the American system.
And we have this here. Even Peter Dutton's quasi-version would do that. We would end up with... Yep. Judges who ever want to be promoted being conscious when they sentence of how this will look in a future to the media in the future. It's really important that they be independent. Yes. And that they not only be independent, but they be immune from public criticism unless there's something genuine. Like, I mean, obviously that judge, that magistrate in New South Wales last week who the bloke from the tent city in Martin Place who allegedly assaulted his partner, and she didn't show up, and the magistrate got really stuck in about women wasting court's resources on and then that's right. What would he say? It was like that kind of conduct that was alleged goes on in every second household every second day.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad because it happens every house. Well, no, that doesn't make it okay, and you've just normalised domestic violence. And
I would like to know, like, which of the people that you know do are throwing their spouses around and pushing them to the ground?
What? Yeah.
Every second day, every second household.
Yep.
How many people do you know? Which half of them are doing this?
That's horrible.
It was mad. So that sort of thing does need review. Like, there needs to be an ability when somebody does something mad like that, because it's not to do with what his sentence was. That's to do with he was making comments which basically contradict the legislation and the legislative intent of Parliament to come back on that. The only other thing I want to flag, one other thing while we're on the subject of criminal justice system, this terrifying idea being trumpeted by the state Liberals in Victoria. By the victims rights advocate, the Victims Crime Commissioner Greg Davies, who has a particular political bent, wants to add a new tax to criminals and others who break the law. So they want to increase put an extra victim's penalty on top of speeding fines, and they want to have an extra punishment for extra amount of money dragged out of people who are found guilty of things in the Magistrates Court. And the Labor Party, the Premier, Dan Andrews is saying, oh, we'll assess the proposal, but we need to work through the details. It's very hard for parties to stand up and say this thing, like a new tax on criminals, is a bad idea. Like, it sounds appealing.
Yep.
Bad people, they should pay more tax. The problem is, there's several problems with this. One is, you're assuming that people have money that you can take.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily the case. And you'll find that a lot of the reason why these, why punishments are not, you know, when restitution orders are made by courts, they're not being recovered, is because the people don't have money.
Yep.
So what are you going to do? Chuck people in debtors' prison for long? Like,
they'd like that.
But that costs us all more too. Like, every time you chuck somebody in prison unnecessarily, you are making it less likely that they'll rehabilitate. It's the whole thing when they fine beggars.
Yes.
For begging. What do you think they're going to do to get the money back?
Yeah.
If you fine people for petty crime, and where are they getting the money from?
Yes.
We also already have a system where once you chuck somebody in prison, they're not going to be able to get work again.
Yes.
Like, you are creating a class that you're stopping people rehabilitating. People don't think, but they're not thinking through these things, because all they're just going is the gut human thing of bad person, I want to punch them.
Yes.
I want to make them, metaphorically, I want them to suffer. And I'm paying tax. Of course criminals should pay more tax. But you can get to the lunacy of it by saying, you know, that person, he's weak on crime. He only wants to add, $100 to people facing the magistrate's court and $350 to people facing the county and Supreme Courts. He's soft on crime.
Yes.
I'd add $20,000.
Yes.
Oh, no, Jeremy, you're really soft on crime. I'd be adding $1 million. Every person convicted of a crime should pay $1 million and they should be locked up in prison forever. And if you want anything less than that, you're soft on crime. It's mad. Like, this is an insane, like, where are they pulling these figures from? There's no basis on which they think that money's going to be recovered, that it's achieved anything.
What I do love is that Matthew Guy says, I'll guarantee that I'll make criminals pay, not just issue a press release saying they will.
That's so, like, dumb.
Really? Are you going to put in the new system at justice that makes them pay, that tracks them down, that gets the money out of them? Out?
Like, how are you getting the money out of people who don't have any
money?
I'll
make them pay.
The other thing that they point out, this is a Herald Sun, because the Herald Sun obviously ran this as like this great new thing. It's like they were running like this big positive for Matthew Guy. But they also point out that this is a thing that has it already exists in South Australia. They already have a system under which offenders facing court pay $160 for a summary offence and $260 for an indictable matter. The infringement rate is 60. Okay, so they've got this system in South Australia. This story is remarkably missing out on something, which is, has it helped? Has it reduced crime? Have they recovered money? Has it made any sense?
Yeah, what has it cost them to recover that money? What is the cost? Has it actually,
So as I was saying before, that they run these things without any care about what the actual outcomes are. Let's just smash criminals. Hang on.
But it even
have you actually figured out if that's going to work or not? Here is an example of where they've tried it. Did it work? Where are the numbers? Mr. Davies said only those who broke the law would pay, so his proposed system was effectively voluntary and would be publicly accepted. I don't think too many level-headed people would be violently opposed, he said. Well, I'm sure level-headed people wouldn't be violently opposed, because being level-headed and violent seem to be contradictory. But no, I think level-headed people go, wait a minute.
He even acknowledges one of the issues here. Mr. Davies said when courts did order perpetrators to pay compensation, victims almost always never saw a cent. The criminals almost invariably refused to pay. No, it's not that they refuse to pay, it's that they literally don't have money.
Yeah, you can sue to recover. If people do have money, then you would sue and recover it, and you would get your costs on top of it. Davies suggested that the state of Victoria should be charged with the task of legally pursuing criminals who refuse to compensate victims. How much would that cost? When you're like, yes, let's tax criminals, are you really, do you like the idea if it actually costs you more money? If it is a net drain on the revenue and you have to pay more tax so that you can chase criminals for tax? But people don't think that's true. So this law and order thing, this is the other reason why law and order in the public is scary, because that's how we end up with mandatory sentences.
Yes.
What are mandatory sentences? Mandatory sentences are the parliament saying, we know ahead of time what the appropriate sentence will be for this offence. We don't need to take into account all the things that a judge or a magistrate takes into account. Now, those things that magistrates and judges take into account aren't, the criminal said that I had a bad childhood and that's an excuse. The factors courts take into account are relevant to issues like rehabilitation and what things are going to be constructed.
They might be the sole caregiver of someone. They might have all of these sorts of issues. Like, there's all sorts of things.
Oh, we have that with mandatory minimum times off the road. If somebody loses their license, but they are... If a rich person loses their license and they live in the middle of Melbourne where they've got brilliant public transport, not a huge penalty for them. Somebody lives in a remote area with no access to public transport and they've got care of a six-month-old baby. That is a hugely different punishment and a huge problem. But the courts, because of the mandatory sentences where they take the discretion away from magistrates, they can't take that into account.
No.
So you have massive injustices.
Not in New South Wales, they can't. Apparently they can in Queensland.
Yeah, but the idea of mandatory sentences
Not New South Wales, Victoria, not in Victoria.
Because when we want to be tough on crime, we bring in mandatory sentences, we say the judges are being soft. What we end up doing is increasing injustices. All right, let's deal quickly with Australia versus Humanity. For refugees who have not been deemed under the rather restrictive system we've got for determining who's a legitimate refugee, those people that can settle in the PNG community, which isn't very helpful, for example, if you're gay, where it's illegal in PNG to be gay and so forth. But anyway, Australia's keeping it there.
That useful for anyone who's a legitimate refugee because the PNG community has stated over and over that they don't want anyone there. They don't want any of the refugees.
So you're not going to be able to build a life there. It's monstrous. Yeah. But anyway, do you know what the choices we're giving everybody else? Remain in a Papua New Guinea jail forever or go back to your home country to face arbitrary detention, torture or death.
That sounds fun.
What a country!
That's like playing Russian roulette where every single barrel of the gun has a bullet.
Yeah, it's good. What a country. Meanwhile, we have also, we are deporting a convicted drug trafficker, so somebody who trafficked cannabis.
Mm.
Cannabis, which I'm willing to bet you will be legal in Australia in the next 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
Anyway. He has lived in Australia. He migrated to Australia as a toddler in 1956. He is 61 years old. He's not 61 years old. It's 61 years later. He's 66 years old. He was 5 when he came. And because of the cannabis, because he didn't become an Australian citizen, he is being deported to Malta at 66, where he has never lived and has no family connection. His family is all here in Australia. He's currently being held in Christmas Island. So basically, he went to jail. He served his time for the cannabis trafficking. But because he wasn't an Australian citizen, even though he's lived here all his life, we're adding the additional punishment of sending him to a country where he has never lived in his life.
That's horrible.
And the High Court has said, if you've failed your because he's technically still on a visa because he was 5 years old. He's failed the test, therefore he's off. And meanwhile, we've got the Human Rights Watch have reported on abuse and neglect of prisoners with disabilities in Australia, which is monstrous reading, but basically particularly racist too, like prisoners leaving. Warning, the next 20-30 seconds of description of what sort of things are happening in custody is quite harrowing, so trigger warning, big trigger warning, and if you don't want to hear it, I'll put a time tag right after it that you can go to. Here's a story from Queensland in 2017. Four officers tackled me. I'd played up the day before, so they were going to teach me a lesson. The senior officer stood on my jaw while the other hit my head in and restrained me. They said, "You don't run this prison, little cunt, we do." And they cut my clothes off. They left me naked on the floor of the exercise yard for a couple of hours before giving me fresh clothes. They probably did it to humiliate me. They called me black cunt heaps of times. It's normal. It's an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander male prisoner with a psychological disability. And there's more. Human Rights Watch had a decent report on it, but nothing much is coming forward from the government about that. So let's leave on to two more light-hearted stories. Queensland is looking at bringing in a Human Rights Act, along with a which will cover things like freedom of expression and right to privacy, so we've got to be careful about which rights they actually give them. I think we need a national... rights, but anyway,
agree.
Queensland's looking into it, so it'll be interesting to see what comes of that. And the final bit, you're a New South Wales person, well, Canadian through New South Wales. Were you following what happened with the Ferry McFerryface thing?
Vaguely.
So this is how bonkers it is. Not only did they spend $100,000 on a competition, this is the New South Wales Transport Minister, mm-hmm. Andrew Constance, the one who was like, I'm looking forward to when we get rid of trains entirely and just have cars. We won't need trains once we have automatic cars. anyway, so he had a competition to reveal to decide on the name. It cost $100,000. Ferry McFerryface, the old internet joke from a couple of years ago, was ineligible to be accepted under its own criteria. Attracted only 182 votes, and so he went to a captain's pick and picked it anyway.
Wow.
Ian Kiernan from Clean Up Australia was the clear winner and got 2,025 votes. Other names on the list included May Gibbs, Joan Jorn Ertzen, Dame Mary Mashir, and artist Ken Doan. So he named Ferry McFerry Face anyway. Then, because of the public furor, he decided to name it after May Gibbs. There's some racism issues with May Gibbs, but anyway. And then that's apparently not even compatible because it was supposed to not be within the arts, and their own criteria for that particular ferry was supposed to be from a different category anyway, so May shouldn't have been in there anyway. But, and the final nonsense part of all of this, Transport for New South Wales outlined naming nominations with various rules of the rules of what they were going to pick, and they had a file called Nonsense Ferry Names. Boaty McBoatface, Ferry McFerryface, Steamed Hams, HSP, Halal Snack Pack, Boaty McBoat, Pemmelwy, Hitler Did Nothing Wrong, Ferry Godmother, Ferry Bread, Tinkerbell, Doogza, Ferry Seinfeld, Budgie Smuggler, The Ferry That Couldn't Slow Down, Eagle Rock, Ferry Floss, Unsinkable 2, Ferris Bueller.
That's excellent. They should have named it Ferris Bueller.
Ferry Good Time, Straya, Westall, Fairgo, Ferry Floss. Now, it feels to me like Pemmelwy should not be in that list.
No, it really shouldn't.
Oh, my goodness. But yeah, Constance, he has a competition. He overrides it for what he thought was the sugar hit of naming it Ferry McFerryface. And then...
He's a bit of a clueless man. I'm just going to say that.
What a job. Anyway, I have had enough of what a glorious week it's been in Australia. Denise, where can people find you?
Here.
On the internet. All right. You don't have anything that you feel like plugging?
No, I don't have anything. I have Twitter at Deency, DEENSEY, but that's about it.
In non-political ways, we could plug your...
I run a comic and geeky business making things, Glam Comics, and I'm on Facebook as Glam Comics. C-O-M-I-X.
Yes.
Comics. Yes.
All right. Thank you to all of our listeners for coming back. Thank you, everybody who's given us a positive review on iTunes.
Hooray, iTunes reviews.
Thank you, Brandon, for returning to do Stuck in My Craw. Thank you. So, Daniel Kamara, our previous editor, is doing brilliantly in his career, but has become... We're saying farewell in terms of him editing the podcast for now. It is a time commitment that he can't do with his new job. So we thank him for many years of doing both Well May We Say and Something Wonky before that. He might return if we do a special Something Wonky election special with Dave. We might do it. Might get the band back together to do a live broadcast if there's an election later this year or next year. So Daniel may be back for that sort of thing. But in terms of weekly editing of the podcast,
we wish Daniel farewell
to Daniel and wish him all the well in his new role, which is very exciting indeed.
Good luck, Daniel.
And thank you, everybody else. And we will see you all next week.
Goodbye.
Hello.